Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm thrilled to have as my guest today Robert Crace. We will be discussing Mr. Crace's new novel, The Two-Minute Rule, recently published by Simon & Schuster, currently available in your bookstores. And first of all, Robert, thank you so much for your time today.
Hey, it's a pleasure. I think we're going to have fun, Casey.
I'd like to go back in time for a moment before we talk about the two-minute rule. It was the fall of 1987. I was in New York City. I walked up the spiral staircase of the Mysterious Bookshop. I saw Otto Penzler, my good friend, sitting behind his desk, and he walked up to me and handed me two paperbacks. And he said, here are two books for you to buy, one's for your collection, one's for you to read. And it was The Monkey's Raincoat. And I looked at him and I said, Otto, I don't buy paperbacks. And he said, I know, but you have to buy this one. And like I say, one goes on your shelf and one you read. And that was the first time I was exposed to your work, Robert, was The Monkey's Raincoat back in 1987. And I've been a fan ever since. And
the book on your shelf, how much is that worth now, Casey?
You know, I haven't looked on eBay recently, Robert, because it's one of the books I won't sell. But, you know, I do also have the first British hardcover edition, you know, when it came out.
You know, Otto has been enormously supportive of me and my work since the beginning of my career. And that example you just cited is indicative of it, that, you know, when I started with Bantam. Bantam was my first publisher. The Monkey's Raincoat, my first book, was published as a paperback original. It was literally entry-level publishing, published as a straight-out, run-of-the-mill, you know, category fiction mystery. I think the print run on that book was probably no more, and this is a paperback we're talking, the print run was probably no more than 22,000 copies. I think as far as it was probably just another throwaway book they were publishing, you know, churning out their monthly publication schedule. But it was thanks to people like Otto Penzler, booksellers, who read the book and found something that they loved or admired about it, and really hand sold that book that's what got my career going and really led to everything that's happened since.
Yes, you know, and I was looking at The Monkey's Raincoat, which, for all the listeners out there, if you've not read it, it's a wonderful read. And I saw that one of the blurbs on the original publication was from Stan Lee from Marvel Productions.
Yep, Stan the Man Lee, the man who, the comics genius who created The Amazing Spider-Man, Incredible Hulk, Fantastic Four, on and on and on. I am today and was as a child a comics fan. I've always been a reader, a movie fan, a fan of storytelling, and comic books are storytelling on a very basic level. Stan Lee was a boyhood hero of mine. So when I grew up, when I became a writer and an adult, I had the happy coincidence of meeting Stan and telling him how much his work had influenced me. And I gave him a copy of the Monkey's Raincoat manuscript, and lo and behold, he absolutely loved it. He gave me an incredible blurb for it to help draw a little attention to the book. And for me, that was like a dream come true, to grow up and actually have one of my boyhood creative heroes find such pride and pleasure in my own work. It was a nice thing.
Sure. And just for a brief digression, prior to The Monkey's Raincoat and then Stalking the Angel, you had done a lot of television writing, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Guilty as charged. Well, look, when I was a young guy down in Louisiana, I wanted to be a writer, period. Not a particular type of writer, not a particular thing. I wrote everything. I was trying to You know, I was teaching myself to write. I was writing short stories. Not just mystery. I was writing mystery stories and submitting them. You know, God, getting gazillions of rejections. But I was also writing science fiction. I was writing fantasy. I even three or four times out of desperation tried writing, confession articles under female pseudonyms. Those got rejected too. So when I decided to come to Hollywood, it wasn't just to write television or any other thing. I wanted to be a writer. I was a huge fan of TV. So I moved to L.A., figuring that would be a way maybe I could make a living at this stuff.
And I saw on your bio that you actually wrote an episode of The Twilight Zone.
Well, not the original Twilight Zone.
Right.
I did. You know, they in the mid-'80s, actually is about the same time that I was working on The Monkey's Raincoat. They brought back The Twilight Zone in a sort of a revival show. I was fortunate enough to write a single episode of that, and I'm very pleased with that show. That too was another boyhood dream come true, because the original Zone with Rod Serling, I mean, my God, I loved that show. It was one of my favorite shows of all time. So my being able to write an episode of The Zone when they brought it back was just another dream.
Sure, I understand. And I've started watching those old reruns myself, and there, Rod Serling was an amazing man, amazing writer, when you think of what he accomplished. Really, the word genius is overused, but I think Rod Serling really was.
I agree. I think he was. The depth of his work was stunning, and he was of that generation, the same generation as Patty Chayefsky and other such writers, who came from New York, from the theater, and they brought that depth and sensibility to their screenwriting work. You don't see that so much anymore.
No.
But Serling himself was a master. He was incredibly influential on me.
Yes. And, Robert, to fast forward a bit, and by the way, Stalking the Angel is one of my favorites as well. It doesn't get mentioned perhaps as much, but I've always liked that.
Thank you very much.
That.
Mine too, by the way.
I'm sorry?
I said mine too, by the way. Stalking has always sort of been lost in the wake of The Monkey's Raincoat. It is sort of like the little brother who tags along behind his high school star athlete older brother. But Stalking, I've always felt is every bit as complex and moving as The Monkey's Raincoat.
Mm-hmm. Now, if we fast forward to L.A. Requiem, which would be considered, I guess, in the popular vernacular, kind of a breakout book for you, you changed the structure of your storytelling. And up until L.A. Requiem, Joe Pike, who was Elvis Cole's sidekick, Joe Pike had been threatening to take over some novels, I think. And it was almost like in L.A. Requiem, you kind of let Joe Pike have his say, and it just seemed like the complexity, the structure of the novel took you to a different place. And when you wrote L.A. Requiem, when you were writing that and when you finished it, did you feel that you had gone to a different level as a writer?
When I finished, well, all during the writing of L.A. Requiem, and certainly when I finished the writing, I was convinced that L.A. Requiem would kill my career.
Really?
Absolutely, really. For weeks on end, no exaggeration, I was literally sick. I was eating Rolaids like you wouldn't believe. I was convinced it was an abject failure. I thought I would be savaged when it was published by critics and reviewers and fans. And I just had no confidence in it whatsoever. And I'll tell you, because it's easier to see it now in retrospect, because a little time has passed. you know, that was a book, the books before that, the seven Elvis Cole novels before that, were all written in sort of the classic Chandlerian format for an American PI novel. You know, everything was first-person point of view from the point of view of the protagonist, Elvis Cole. That was the traditional format for a PI novel. That's the way it was supposed to be done. And, you know, I love those books. I love Chandler and Hammett and the other masters. But toward the end of that run of seven books, and I think it started with maybe Sunset Express, I broke point of view for the first time in Sunset Express, and that only in a prologue. I included a prologue in that book that was not with Elvis Cole or Joe Pike. It was a third-person piece following other characters. Then in Indigo Slam, I did the same thing again. And what that was me sort of testing the water, me seeing how it felt to me to change the way all the masters had written Private Eye novels.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was beginning to feel that. You know, I wanted to do it. I wanted to kick out the jams, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to open up the doors. I had known for a couple of years, several years, that I wanted to write Joe Pike's story, which is kind of the way I think of L.A. Requiem. But it was, the more I thought about it, the more I grew to feel that, you know, I really couldn't give Joe the proper service if I told that novel, if I told his story in the way I had been writing the other novels, if I told Joe's story through Elvis Cole's eyes. It just seemed that it would give Joe a short shrift. So by the time I got to L.A. Requiem after experimenting in Sunset and Indigo, I decided to go for it. And that meant abandoning the solely first-person point of view of the earlier books. You know, I went first-person, yes, with Elvis, but also third-person. I went multiple storylines instead of a single storyline. I did flashbacks, not just present time. And because it all seemed so chancy and risky to me, I absolutely had no confidence in it whatsoever. It was a much bigger... It was three times longer than The Monkey's Raincoat.
Mm-hmm.
Many places in that book I felt totally lost. I felt overwhelmed by the quantity of emotion in the book. All of that stuff is sort of easy to say now intellectually. But at the time I was terrified. And like I said, I really did have no confidence whatsoever in it.
Now, with the way the writing and the publishing process works, Robert, when Demolition Angel, which came out in 2000 featuring Carol Starkey, did you start Demolition Angel, some of the fears from L.A. Requiem, did that kind of spill over into saying, maybe I want to write a different type of novel, a non-series novel, or were you completely finished with L.A. Requiem when you began Demolition Angel?
I was totally finished with. I didn't actually begin the writing, of course, of Demolition Angel until after L.A. Requiem was finished. But in many ways, Demolition Angel grew out of L.A. Requiem, and I'll tell you why. L.A. Requiem was primarily about a murder investigation, and it was. You know, in addition to being a Private Eye novel, the way I thought of it is that it was also a suspense thriller, and it was also a police procedural.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because of the procedural aspects of it that I began to do an enormous amount of research into how LAPD handled a homicide scene, how they handled a homicide investigation, etc. As part of my research for that, I interviewed an SID criminalist, a scientific investigations division criminalist from LAPD, because I wanted to know what criminalists did at a murder scene. And just by happenstance, SID shares its space with LAPD's bomb squad. So I went to see the criminalist and see where the criminalist had their offices and labs, and I just found myself there with the bomb squad, and I was fascinated by those guys. You know, when I pulled into the parking lot, here are all these big, you know, Suburbans, you know, painted black, you know, painted bomb squad on the side. Here were the bomb techs walking around in you know, their black commando fatigues. And I got the criminalist to bring me through the bomb squad, and I was fascinated. And then when I was talking to a couple of bomb squad guys, I discovered that there was a couple of female bomb techs. And what really set me off, and by that I mean what told me, I just felt there was a story here. They were letting me, they were showing me all their toys and, you know, their gear.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to slip on the armored suit, which weighs, the particular model that the LAPD was using at the time, weighed 95 pounds.
Wow.
That sucker is heavy.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I put that thing on and man, you know, it was heavy. And it's one thing when the bomb tech who's, you know, saddling you up with that is some big guy, looks like a college linebacker, weighs 230. He says, "Here you go, put this on, ha, 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 ha." And then I walk through the office, and I meet this woman who weighs 125 pounds, and she's a bomb tech, too. And she has to put that thing on, and it's almost damn near 100% of her body weight.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I said, I have met a woman named Carol Starkey, and I want to write her story.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, Demolition Angel did come out of L.A. Requiem.
Okay. And the suspense in that novel is just, it just builds. I loved Demolition Angel. Then in 2001, Hostage, which most of the listeners have read or seen the film. And that obviously was another, took you to another level in your career as an author, I would assume.
I think both, well, certainly commercially, and I think artistically too. I mean, when I was writing DA, I was thinking in terms that, well, I'll finish Demolition Angel, I have this character, Carol Starkey, I want to write this kind of book, and then I'll go back to Elvis, because I already had a notion for the next Elvis novel, which was to become The Last Detective. But then, bang, I got this idea for Jeff Talley, and I was fascinated by the whole notion of Talley as a SWAT negotiator and then an ex-SWAT negotiator. And I saw an opportunity in Hostage to write yet again a different kind of super high pressure thriller, and it worked out for me. I think, I mean, creatively, I think these books, Demolition Angel and then Hostage, were, I mean, they were successful as far as what my goals were. I felt far more confident about, you asked about my confidence level on L.A. Requiem, and I have already told you I had none.
Yeah.
But when I was writing both Demolition Angel and Hostage, maybe writing L.A. Requiem was sort of like me breaking through the wall or the membrane. But when I was writing D.A. and Hostage, I had a far higher level of confidence about those books. I felt more in tune with what I was writing and the way I was writing it. And, each one, I mean, commercially speaking, L.A.R. was my breakthrough book. It way more than doubled my previous sales. But then, you know, Demolition Angel and Hostage were also like just big jumps forward for me. Hostage became a New York Times bestseller. I actually became a bestseller around the world. And, you know, then Willis bought the film rights, and it really kind of brought me forward as a writer.
Mm-hmm. Then in 03 and in 05, we'll wrap this part of the conversation up before we get to the two-minute rule. You returned to Elvis Cole.
Right.
And I will mention that The Forgotten Man is available in paperback now by Ballantine Books. And you hint the characters of Ben and Ben Chenier, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah, Lucy Chenier and
Lucy Chenier.
Ben Chenier.
They become an important part of Elvis's life. And I'm wondering, Robert, in light of what's happened down in Louisiana, if that's going to work its way into the Elvis Cole series, the impact that's had on the characters' lives, particularly in light of the fact that you come from Louisiana.
Absolutely. There's no, I can't not write about Katrina and the aftermath of Katrina. You know, I was down there. I am from Louisiana. I still have a lot of friends and family down there. And simply by bad luck, I was down there in the Gulf with a good buddy of mine when Katrina paid its visit and was part of the, we were down in Metairie, that's where he lives, and I was part of the evacuation that weekend. We left Metairie, made our way up to Baton Rouge along with a couple hundred thousand other people. I'm originally from Baton Rouge, so I have friends and family up there, too. And I got out of BR on one of the, I think maybe the last flight, one of the last flights before they closed the airport there.
Wow.
I had been booking flights out of New Orleans all day long on that, on the Saturday before the storm hit, and they kept canceling the flights out from under me, and we finally just bailed and hit the road for Baton Rouge. But now the storm hit, and in fact, the buddy I was with, his home was flooded, had a couple of feet of water in it. He has to totally rebuild. I had, you know, other friends lost their homes. I had a couple of cousins lost their homes. I've been down there several times since Katrina. I'm trying to help in, you know, the recovery efforts in whatever way I can, and it's far more devastating when you're there and you're seeing it than anything you can see on the TV. The scope and the scale of it is simply horrifying. So I can't not write about that. You know, in the books, Lucy Chenier and Ben are from Louisiana. At the end of The Last Detective, they moved back to Baton Rouge.
Mm-hmm.
They were living in Baton Rouge during the course of The Forgotten Man, and so of course they have been affected by the events surrounding Katrina. So, in at least a future book, I'm going to have to deal with that. I can't not deal with that.
Sure,
it's something I desperately want to write about.
Sure, I understand. Well, Robert, that brings us up to the 2-minute rule, and the 2-minute rule, I would recommend to the listeners out there that give yourself some time when you start it, because you're not going to want to put it down once you get into the story. Max Holman is the protagonist, also known as the Hero Bandit. And tell the listeners, if you would, what the 2-minute rule is when it comes to robbing a bank.
Well, Max is a bank robber, and there's a rule of thumb in bank robbery. And it's this: once a bank robber initiates the robbery, almost immediately, someone in the bank, a teller, is gonna press a silent alarm. That's called a 211 alarm, because that's the penal code for robbery in progress. The minimum time it would take for that alarm to cycle through to a first responder like a police officer, the minimum, absolute minimum time is 2 minutes, which means a bank robber has about 2 minutes to pull his job and get away. And every second that he or she is in that bank longer than 2 minutes increases the odds they're going to be caught. So don't let time run out.
That's amazing. And then I've read where some of these guys are so good, they get in and out of there in less than 2 minutes.
Well, there are different kinds of bank robberies. There's note jobs, which is what most robberies are. Note job is where you just walk in, you go to a teller, you give the teller a note, give me your money. There are other kinds of robberies that are called takeover robberies. You might recall a few years ago there was a horrendous shootout at a bank in North Hollywood here in California. It was in 1997, where two guys dressed up like commandos, in black gear and had machine guns, went into a bank, took the bank over, and stayed in there about 8 or 10 minutes, then came out and had a huge gun battle with police. That was two clowns named Phillips and Mazzarano. They were killed at the scene. The takeover robberies where you go in and literally take over the bank. Some of these guys, unlike Phillips and Mazzarano, are professionals, and they operate with all the efficiency of an elite military unit. There was one guy who was he and his partner were working. Florida and Georgia robbed about 6 or 8 banks. They never took complete takeover jobs. Again, commando gear, machine guns, masks, stopwatches, the whole loads. They would go in, totally dominate a bank, totally take it over, get the vault money, get the teller money, and be out. And they never stayed in the bank longer than 55 seconds.
That's incredible. I can't even get to the refrigerator and get a bottle of water in less than 55 seconds.
Me neither.
Now, another of the important characters in the two-minute rule is Catherine Pollard. And one of the things I really like about the two-minute rule is it becomes a love story about two people that have absolutely nothing materially.
Right.
And you read a lot of novels that of people that fall in love, and particularly out in California, and they've pretty much got it made. They either rode the internet boom or they're successful doing whatever. One of the things I liked about the two characters here is that they both really are starting life with not much to go on, and you manage to create a love story between the two of them, which I found to be very moving as during the course of the novel.
They're both people who've made bad mistakes. At least they feel they've made bad mistakes. Holman in particular, of course, the thing I liked about Max Holman is the sense of regret that he carries with him.
Mm-hmm.
When we meet him, he's 46 years old. He's just getting out of prison. He's been in prison for 10 years for bank robbery. And Holman is a guy who's been a career criminal. I mean, there was a woman in the past that he loved and he had a child with, but they never got married. And he was a drunk and a drug addict and a car thief and a bank robber and just a career criminal. And he has lived, in essence, a loveless life. And now when we meet him, he's getting out of prison, and there's no one to meet him. There's no one for him to go to because he has led a life without love. And he regrets that. The thing about Holman that I admire is that he's learned his lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, at this late stage in his life, after 10 years in prison, a classically misspent youth, he's learned his lesson. He regrets his past choices. He wants to rise above himself. He actually genuinely wants to become a better person. But consequently, when the book opens and he finds out that his estranged son, this now young man that he has absolutely no relationship with, 23-year-old police officer, has been murdered. Holman has no one to turn to. He's absolutely alone, and the only person he can think to trust is the cop who arrested him and put him in prison for bank robbery, and that's Catherine Pollard, who's now, because of her own choices, has left the FBI and is regretting it. You know, she's on her heels, and you have these two people who are trying to rebuild themselves, who are trying to make changes in their lives for the better. And I'll tell you, when I was writing them and I brought them together, I wasn't sure how that would play out. I didn't know if they would. You know, it's one thing when you're thinking about the book you're going to write, you're thinking about these characters. It's one thing to say, okay, well, I'll get these two guys together, and then, you know, we'll let the sparks fly, and it'll be one of those romances.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't know that it's going to work out like that when you get there.
Right.
You know, when you're writing the characters and they're starting to come alive on the page, and they're developing their attitudes, it can go in any direction, and. It worked out. It certainly worked out a little differently than what I had originally imagined, but there does seem to be a mutual respect growing between these two people that I like a lot.
Mm-hmm. And I think all of us. I'm 48 years old, and I think there are certain things about our past that haunt us, and it seems to be that Max Holman is haunted of the past of. Perhaps what he has done to his son, and we're not going to give any of the plot away because I don't do that on this show, but one of Max's real fears is that his behavior has caused his son to become the type of man that he feared that he would become, and I like the way you deal with that. Part of the plot, and I'll leave it at that in terms of explaining to the listeners what it is that I'm talking about, except that Max Holman does have that feeling that's driving him on of that perhaps he has damaged his son.
I think that contributes to Max's sense of that is again part of his character that I find heroic. When I first proposed this notion, the notion for the two-minute rule, to my agent and my publisher, you know, I think the hair on their heads stood up. They said, "Oh my God, your main character is going to be a bank robber? What are you talking about? It's not going to be sympathetic. There's no way that guy's going to be sympathetic." I never saw him as any other way.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I first conceived of him, he was that guy. He would be the guy who, you know, at this point in his life, he is worried that his past behavior has damaged his son. He's worried that his past behavior, he's more than aware of it, and he's ashamed by it, and he genuinely. On the day he's getting out of prison, he genuinely hopes that he can make amends for all his past sins.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And another part of the 2-minute rule, which has a classic feel to it, is there's that search for the Holy Grail or the lost treasure, and what lengths would men go to find the secret treasure, which is. Kind of like you say, going back to your comic book roots, there's almost like the lottery or something like that. People are looking
absolutely.
For a shortcut.
It's mythic here in our culture, probably every culture. You know, it's a treasure of the Sierra Madre. It's Lost Dutchman's mine. It's gold fever. But you know what? That comes from more than a couple, from real incidents. Let me float this for you. I mentioned earlier Phillips and Matt Serrano, the two takeover bandits who were killed in North Hollywood. They began their criminal careers robbing armored cars. They knocked over three armored cars, and they got about $120,000 from that. Then they moved on to banks. They robbed two banks before the North Hollywood Bank, where they were killed. The first bank they robbed, they got $750,000. The second bank they robbed, they got $790,000. Third bank, they were killed. After the investigation, the FBI was only able to account, and that includes expenditures, hidden cash, etc., they were only able to account for about half that money. The other half, about $750,000, is still missing. It's just out there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, buried in a backyard, trunk of a car, storage space. It's just out there. Give you another one. And this is the one that really gave me this whole subplot or background crime for the two-minute rule. It wasn't a bank robbery. Also in 1997, I guess it was a good year for crime here in L.A., the Dunbar Armored Car Company, not an armored car, but the armored car company, was robbed of $18.9 million cash.
Wow.
It was the single largest cash robbery in United States history. Six men did it, led by a former Dunbar employee named Alan Pace. They were eventually caught. They are now all in prison. Alan Pace was 32 at the time. He was sentenced. He was sentenced for 24 years, I believe it was, in prison. Okay, they got $18.9 million. At the end of the investigation, the FBI and the authorities were only able to account for $4.5 million of that money.
Hmm.
The other $14 million is missing. It's still out there.
Okay.
Casey, finders keepers.
Robert, do you have any idea where it's at? I'm in Columbus, Ohio, but...
here's what I have an idea of. Alan Pace, I believe he's sentenced to 24, so it's federal time. It means he has to serve 85% of the time before he's released. He'll be released after 20 years. He was 32 when he went in. He'll be 52 years old. The day he steps out those prison doors, I think there's going to be an awful lot of people watching him.
I would have to agree with you on that, and I hope that I'm not one of them. So,
it'll be you and I sitting in a car.
Yeah,
oculars.
Yeah, Robert, I have one other thing I want to ask you before we wrap it up, but I want to recommend to the listeners the 2-minute rule published by Simon & Schuster by Robert Crace. It's a wonderful novel, and I'm so pleased that you're writing the Elvis Coles and the standalones. And did I read, Robert, that it when you started the 2-minute rule that you considered having this be an Elvis Cole novel?
Absolutely. It did start as an Elvis Cole novel. I was thinking about, you know, who are the people who come to Elvis Cole when they need help? You know, me, you, most people, if there's a problem or a crime, you go to the police department. What if you couldn't go to the police department? And then I began to think about possibilities. You know, who couldn't go to the police? And ultimately, I decided that a criminal. And then I began to think about that criminal, someone who has no sophistication, no education, no money, nothing. He can't afford to go to Elvis Cole, so he's alone. And when I got to that place, suddenly the Max Holman as a notion was there for me, and I knew the power of this story comes from his isolation.
Mm-hmm.
I had this character, and I didn't want him to go to Elvis Cole. I didn't want him to be able to go to Elvis Cole. I wanted him totally isolated,
mm-hmm.
totally on his own. I mean, the complete outsider.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I said, hey, okay, we just took a hard left turn, and, you know, this can't be an Elvis Cole novel.
Okay.
It has to be a standalone.
Yeah, okay, good. And the question I've wanted to ask you is, and a lot